You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to NSPS Radio Hour for another edition. For our regular listeners, you will remember that today is the third in a series about UAV, UAS. You'll recall that our first one a couple of weeks ago was with John Politiello, and then last week we had an aviation lawyer, Greg Winton, join us. And we got some good information about this whole subject. And John, of course, provided some information with regard to what's going on legislatively and regulatory-wise. And Greg talked to us about some legal aspects. And today, the guy you really want to hear from is somebody who's involved in it. And so, that said, I want to welcome Jeff Lovin back to the show. Thanks, Jeff, for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. It's great to be here again. Appreciate the opportunity.
I know a lot of people are interested in this, and we thought it was important, Jeff, that we kind of give the broad brush for everybody so they get a sense of the whole thing. But I know the nitty-gritty is what they're really interested in.
Yeah.
And you're able to give up that because at Wolpert's you guys have gotten involved in this already. And I don't know how unique that is, to tell you the truth. In terms of companies, maybe you can enlighten us about that a little bit.
I think maybe a year and a half ago when we first started, I think we were definitely unique. But a lot of folks are seeing the potential for this technology, and I think there's a lot of firms going to catch up real quick. But still probably when you look at our industry, it's probably still a handful of firms that have went ahead and made some sort of investment, in the technology to date. But we started about 18 months ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is probably not one of those things that you saw an article about and said, gee, I think I'll go out and buy one of those tomorrow. I'm sure there was a lot of preparation that went into it.
Yeah, I remember back to a ASPRS conference where I was on a panel discussion, and I believe the discussion was actually about sensors, but it migrated over related to sensors to aircraft and platforms, and the comment was made that, our whole industry is using fleets of twin-engine Cessnas, a lot of which have not been manufactured since the late 70s. And the discussion revolved around, at some point, we all meticulously maintain our aircraft, like our three big piston twins, we fly them so often, they have new engines every year. But at some point, those airframes are just, they can't fly forever. And there was a lot of discussion around that, and it kind of drifted towards, well, I guess we'd go buy these microjets and so forth. And I remember saying then, folks, that won't work because, you can purchase a large twin-engine Cessna for around $250,000. You're talking in the millions of dollars for a microjet of the same size. And I said, look, our clients aren't going to automatically pay 10 times the fee for aerial mapping or LIDAR or whatever we're collecting just because we changed our platform and had to go to a jet. And I made the comment then that I thought we had to start looking at unmanned systems. And I remember quite a few chuckles around the room, but, even a blind squirrel every now and then is right, and it looks like that's sure the way we're heading, is that things are going to head more towards an unmanned platform. So about 2 years ago, 18 months ago, we got real serious about it and started evaluating different types of UAVs that were available.
A little bit off topic, perhaps, but it's something that's intrigued me, and I'm not an aerial guy. I mean, I didn't grow up around an airport or didn't travel very much till I started this job or started working in the NSPS infrastructure years ago. I know people who own planes, private owners, and some are just recreational owners, and, of course, some are folks like you. But one of the things that's always intrigued me about that is the age of the airplanes that people fly.
Yeah. Yeah, until I got up in management in this business, I didn't realize the fact either that they're – Many models made by Cessna and the other manufacturers, most of them stopped, back in the late 70s after the big oil and gas crunch and the recession. the interest dropped off, and of course, like everything else, liability and everything, that a lot they stopped manufacturing a lot of the aircraft that basically is a key part of our business today.
Do you know, I mean, so many things that happen, we always look back and look at a particular company or a particular individual who revolutionized something or other, whether it be a particular way we practice or what. And of course, we all know that GPS came about sort of as a collective effort. But was there a revolutionary entity or research institute or anybody that came up with this whole concept of the UAV?
Oh gosh, I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of it is, I think, as many stuff here in the United States trickled down out of, military application. And
that's what I was kind of thinking it must be, because we know there's a military application, and that would make perfect sense if that's where it came from. I just didn't know if there was.
Yeah, and I'm sure there was other applications, but I tell you, just we've all been trained from the news and so forth. I know that's one of the hurdles that we're going to have to overcome with this technology is when you mention a UAV, UAS, first thing people image in their mind is some image from the news of, a Predator or a Global Hawk shooting a missile at a bad guy in Iraq or Afghanistan. So that's definitely created a public perception issue of these things, and that's where... For us, it's like, hey, we're just trying to make some maps, and we've been doing it for 40 years. You just may or may not have been aware of it, right?
As a matter of fact, in my conversations with John and Greg, both of them brought up that exact point in terms of the word drone itself has become almost like Darth Vader.
Oh, yeah. I've outlawed that word at Wolpert. That's a joke, but I'm pretty serious about it. And just that connotation of the word drone, it's like let's not call it that.
and unfortunately, our news media can't help themselves.
Oh, I know. No matter how many times I've been interviewed or done articles about it, and I'll say UAS 500 times, when it comes out in print, they'll replace it with drone.
Yeah, that is, and that negative connotation surely makes people think differently about it. And now I think we mentioned this with Greg last week. This whole idea of delivering packages with them, and all kinds of stuff in addition to mapping. I mean, it's just phenomenal, really. It's kind of crazy. So obviously, when you were talking here a while back, and you were talking about this whole thought process began to develop. I'm certain there must have been some sort of deliberative process you guys went through to say, okay, this looks like something that might be coming down the pike, and we probably should get on board with figuring out what's going to work for us. But that must have taken quite a bit of thought.
Yeah, it did. And we set aside a couple individuals and kind of made it their main mission is to explore this technology. So we started going to conferences, started reaching out to different vendors and so forth. And one thing that was surprising right off the bat is there's a lot of hundreds of these different kinds of aircraft out there, but we had a lot of trouble finding any of them that had anything near a metric camera that you could do precise measurement from, or i.e., do mapping. That was one of the roadblocks we ran into real early in our research. But we finally, thankfully, we did run into a company, Altavian, that was basically their mission. Their business plan was to build a mapping UAV. So we were real happy to finally find them, and that's who we ended up purchasing our first system from.
So I guess in thinking about that in terms of the company itself and how they developed an application, that begs the question, I suppose, of how does one figure that out? I mean, I know I talked to John and Greg a little bit about this too, but if you go to a surveyors conference these days, and certainly a mapping conference, you're going to see folks out there that have got some version of a UAV that they can fly around the room and make people dodge their heads as they come past and all that kind of stuff. But how does one figure out whether something like that actually works for them or not?
Yeah, well, just on your own dime, doing a lot of testing. there's a big wrinkle in this, of course, is that Wolpert cannot legally go fly this system that we bought and own because, and I'm sure Greg and John got into that quite a bit, but, the airspace isn't open for the private sector. So what we have done is we've partnered with the Sinclair Community College, which is, if not, one of the largest community colleges in the country, and they've started quite a robust UAS program, and they're there in Dayton, Ohio, where we're headquartered, and so we've partnered with them, and they actually fly our system. They have some airspace in Wilmington, Ohio, and they actually have flown our system several times. What we do is work with the data. So they fly it. We analyze data. We go out and do field checks and so forth. So, it's been through a lot of trial and error to get to where we are today, where I think we're ready to go.
Now, when they're doing that, is that something they do, is that some sort of a federal contract or a federal allocation to them to do testing, or did they just take it up on their own?
They took it upon their own. I think, I think they got some grants and money from the state. There's a Wilmington Air Park is I think it goes back to around the World War II area, a nice large airfield out east of Cincinnati that DHL had occupied, first Airborne Express before their demise, and then DHL used it as a hub. So it's a beautiful, very large airport, and unfortunately DHL vacated it as well. So it's been a real problem to that rural community for jobs and what have you. So Ohio, the governor, Governor Kasich, it's one of the technologies he's embracing, kind of got behind that, and they've kind of redeveloped that whole airpark as a UAS test center. And Sinclair's invested a lot of its money there. There's a lot of industry partners, the university, of course, the state's behind it, and they've developed this UAS test center there. So companies like us are able to, partner there and do testing and research through the university.
Well, when we get back from the break, let's talk a little bit about that, how that works.
All right.
Attention surveyors. Are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
Whether cruising the strip in a 57 Chevy or taking the family on a vacation in a 71 Oldsmobile Vista Cruiser, you need to tune in to Classic Cars with Steve Rinaldo and Jim Weber every Saturday from 8 to 9 a.m. on americaswebradio.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
Quick steaks are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden steaks, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Steaks, go to www.quicksteak.com or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
You're listening to americaswebradio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back with Jeff Lovin today talking about what I'm referring to as practical application in our series on UAV, UAS. And Jeff's talking to us, of course, because he's been involved in some of that. And before we get back to talking about the testing over at the college, I was just thinking as we were talking about when you said that you all decided to get into it and then you you found or knew about this community college that was a site. That's kind of a leap of faith, I guess, right off the bat, knowing you're going to buy something that you can't personally use right away.
Yes, it was. But again, the kind of betting on the come, if you will. But I do believe this will be relevant to our market and so forth. And when the FAA does clear the airspace for private companies such as mine to do this, I wanted to be ready to hit the ground running and hopefully be able to make a buck or two at it. So to do that, we couldn't wait till the FAA said, okay, you're clear to fly. You know, I knew there had to be a lot of testing, had to develop a workflow, had to settle on softwares, so the aircraft's just the beginning. Beyond that, you've got to figure out how you're going to, produce a viable product for our clients at the end of the game. So it was a risk and a huge investment, right? It was unfunded. It was just our decision to go ahead and spend these last 18 months getting ready.
Since this is set up so that private sector can't do what St. Clair Community College is doing, and maybe government entities around the country, I don't really know, is it something that several schools or other agencies or whatever are doing, or is what they're doing kind of unique too?
I think what we've got going on in Ohio is pretty unique, but no, a lot of universities are embracing this technology and starting, UAS programs around the country. I know I get phone calls from quite a few, but yeah, a lot of universities are jumping on this idea. Government entities as well. A lot of federal agencies are starting UAS programs and buying these systems, and which, being a private sector guy, being a business guy, that's an area of concern because a lot of these are my current clients that I've flown data for years, and now they're buying their own UAVs and going out and collecting data, and that's obviously work that we've done in the past. So that's another reason I hope the FAA stays on its schedule here for 2015 and allows private companies to participate.
Yeah, that just from the private business perspective, which is the one I've always come from, of course, it does seem like, I don't know if this is maybe not the right terminology, but almost seems like an unfair advantage when you're allowing one sector to become really well-skilled at doing this through this process and allowing them to do things that your business sector isn't being able to do. And we both know from our experiences that there's a tendency to have that competition going on between the private sector and the public sector in terms of offering services. So I can see where that would be of concern.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an unintended consequence. There's no grand design. Because it is I give FAA credit, it is a tough issue. When you picture, I'm just thinking of going out and doing aerial mapping, but when you see a lot of people saw the stuff on the news about Amazon wanting to deliver packages. And right. When you think of how many people are going to want to start flying these things for some business purpose, air safety is a huge issue that the FAA is in charge of. So I don't belittle the task in front of them at all. But it is an unintended consequence when the government is able to do it and we can't, that we may get behind in a bit in the, which again is why we went ahead and made the investment to, I want to be ready day one.
Right. Now, what are we talking about size-wise to do the kind of things you want to do in terms of the actual unit itself? I mean, obviously everybody knows what an airplane looks like, but yeah. What are we talking about?
So our system is it's probably roughly a 6 foot long, 6 or 7 foot long, with about a 5 foot wingspan roughly. And it only weighs 11 pounds. It's all very, hand form composite material. So it's pretty lightweight, flies at about 600 foot altitude. I think over the years, over time, as the way FAA is looking at it, they're opening up different classes of airspace. If you picture vertical slices by altitude of airspace, they're going to open up the lowest altitude, which we would fit in with this 600 feet or under system of ours. But over time, I think we'll be flying larger systems. But our initial system for now that we're looking at, it's about a 6-foot length and just weighs 11 pounds.
Yeah, I think I might have mentioned this on one of the other shows, but a good friend of mine out in Montana has a pretty big place out there, and his son actually is designing some of these things, and he took me into, they've built a, I think he's working with one of the manufacturers, I don't know if it's Northrop Grumman or somebody, but it's maybe Boeing out there, I don't know if they're out on the West Coast, I'm not really sure who it is, but he's doing some design on those things, and he's got a little runway out there, and he tests them, and it's pretty cool to, I mean, he's got this big, huge, like a huge garage, and these little things sitting all over the place.
Yeah.
And they're all different types of fuel. You know, some are electric and some are gas. And and I don't know if that makes a difference in terms of what you're able to do with them. But.
Well, it does. And so our system is electric. Obviously, some of the systems I'm aware of with gas, obviously you can get higher altitude, longer duration flight times and what have you. But our particular system's electric. The benefit of electric is typically less vibration, so less to worry about there with your camera. But we have about a 90-minute flying window on one battery pack.
So if you were going to – how would that work then if somebody called you up and said, I need you to come out and map 300 or 400 acres for me? Would you be able to take off and land just – do you have to have a designated place for that? I guess maybe that's not been settled yet. I don't know. But.
Well, you do. And, again, literally, Wolpert cannot – we couldn't oblige that request right now. But again, even these universities and government entities that can fly, they still have to apply to the FAA for a certificate of authorization. Or COA is the acronym, and that clearly defines, you know, a box. I mean, that maps out exactly where this system will fly, and it gets even specific to the point of the actual system. So not only is it we want this box of airspace to fly a UAV, you have to specify, get into detail about the actual UAV itself, and so the approval process is for a designated area and a specific aircraft.
So, they set that airspace size just based on some geographic coordinates or something?
Yeah. I mean, it's usually client-driven to request the area. And so for example, Wilmington Air Park, it's basically they've taken over one of the existing runways and then some area to the south of the airfield, still airport property, but it's undeveloped property on the south edge of the airport. It's a large rectangle area that Sinclair Community College sought, you know, this COA from the FAA and got approval. And of course, being at an airport makes it nice because it's you know, there's the air traffic tower, because it's still an active airport. They're bringing other businesses in, but it's a designated area and also has to be approved for one or, you know, whatever system you intend to fly has to be part of that COA application.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that comes to mind, and maybe these things are not being considered yet, but it seems to me if you're talking about that, and again, we're talking down the road here, what might happen, I guess, not what's approved right now, but just thinking down the road, if somebody has a project today and they called you and said, we need you to come over here and fly something for us, and we're in the next state over.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I assume that you can fly your plane from wherever it's sitting over there and fly and get what the data you need and come back and process it and what have you. When we go to this kind of situation, how do you do that?
Yeah, well, that's something we were talking about logistically. And so I see us having several of these systems. Probably, you know, since with us having several offices around the country, we'll probably base these systems in several offices so they're more geographically within reach. But, yeah, I mean, I see them, you know, this thing comes in a carrying case. It's a big, long, you know, 5-foot-long hard case. But, you know, this thing, we'll be shipping them around. We'll be carrying them, hauling them to different project locations. We did other countries are open to this technology already. Pretty much most countries are around the world. And, we did a project in Colombia. And, we sent our U.S. folks, and they shipped the system down in the case, and they assemble it very quickly, and we did the project, and then they flew home and shipped it home. But that will be an issue, and that's where I think we've got to get used to the idea of a lot of our clients will have these as well, and right now my clients don't go by Cessna aircraft and these sensors to do mapping, where they call us and we literally, like you said, have to fly over there, fly to the site and do the work. These are such low cost. I think more and more of my clients will own these, and what Wolpert has to be ready to do is support that so that they may have their own system. Or, we may do like training programs, right? We may send the training and we may train certain clients and, ship them the system, let them operate it, and then they send us the data, because they're again, it's just like every other technology. There's a whole lot behind the curtain beyond just buying the system. That if you want it, at the end of the day, you're trying to solve a problem, and you're trying to make a map. You're trying to do a site development or what have you, and that expertise is what we still have in house, and so we're going to have to be ready to ingest data from. We bought one particular system. We may be able to have to ingest data from 50 different systems and be able to process that data and make some kind of product out of that.
Right. We got pretty close to the break here, so when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about looking ahead at that future and the processing side of things, because as we both know now, there are lots of firms out there doing mapping and processing the data for all kinds of use. And, of course, on the surveyor side, processing data for surveyors and their clients to build something or design something. And I've heard lots of those people being concerned about this, particularly a lot of the smaller operators. And so when we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit about that in terms of that processing. What the data is really going to look like? Is it different? Is it the same? And how does the whole processing side of it occur? So let's go to the second break and we'll come back and talk about that.
Great.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on americaswebradio.com.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Schonstadt, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Stakes, go to www.quickstake.com or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
You're listening to americaswebradio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back, everybody. We're at the time of our show where our sponsor, Parker Davis Quick Stakes, has the email contest every week where you can email the answer in that I'm going to elicit from Jeff here in a minute, and the first person to do that to quickstakescontest@americaswebradio.com will win today. So the question today is, Jeff, what was the name again of the company that you bought from?
Altavion.
Is that A-L-T-A-V-I-O-N?
A-N. A-L-T-A-V-I-A-N.
Yeah. Altavion. Okay. Is it, just out of curiosity, is that a new company or is it?
It is. It's some fine young men. They're from Gainesville, Florida. All basically survey and photogrammetry guys that graduated out of that strong program there at University of Florida, and went together and built this company to manufacture survey and mapping UAS systems. And I think the wise old sage CEO is probably in his early 30s.
Oh, wow.
So, great company of some really smart young men, and like I said, I was really happy for us to partner with them to find those guys.
Well, our buddy Dave Gibson will be proud. Do you know Dave?
I do.
Yeah, I can't say he founded that program, although I think he might have, but he certainly has been instrumental over the years in making it strong.
Yeah.
No question about that. So, well, that's always good. You like to see people take and leverage the education and experience they've got to be able to apply it to something like this. I mean, that's pretty creative, actually.
Yeah, it is. And like I said, it was quite a challenge. There's a lot of systems out there that collect imagery. A lot of systems collect video. But it was one of the very few we found that had a geometrically accurate camera that you take some, precise measurements for mapping and survey with.
I guess that's a really good question, and I want to come back to the processing thing in a minute, but when we think about flying and getting information in the air for surveying and mapping purposes, our tendency is to think about big cameras and airplanes.
Correct.
And I don't know how true that is still, actually, if they still are big cameras, but if this thing weighs 6 pounds, this is not going to be a big camera.
Yeah. It's you can hold it in the palm of your hand. It's amazing. And again, Altavion does not manufacture the camera. They buy it from a third party, and it's a company that, until this I'd never heard of, but they're big in the defense industry and they built a lot of cameras for military applications. But it is it'll rest in the palm of your hand. All electronic shutter camera. But with a very good geometry, so we can do triangulate imagery with ground control.
What does the time perspective look like? Because I'm sitting here trying to envision the unit flying over an area to be mapped or collecting data for it, and comparing that to a plane that's flying at a pretty high altitude and gathering maybe a broader field or certainly a broader field. Does that have a big impact on time in terms of collection?
Sure. And it's kind of all relative to scale, if you will. So, again, being such a small system, flying at 600 feet, you rightly so a few minutes ago mentioned 300 or 400 acres. That would be a typical project that, you'd fly within an hour maybe or so. So it's all relative. So, again, that our applications we see are for those smaller area, I see a great application, us being also a civil engineering firm, for, commercial or whatever type of development, right, where there may be some development, highway construction, corridor, type up. So any kind of development area, project site, site-specific type, where again, maybe not too cost-effective to bring a big aircraft in to do 300 or 400 acres, you definitely could do it by field survey. We do that today with RTK technology and what have you, but the UAS kind of fills a gap right there that could greatly speed up. So when you compare it to how you might do 300 or 400 acre topo using field survey, it's much faster. If you compare it to bringing in a assessment 404. It's two passes. You're there for 10 minutes. It's done. The imagery's collected. The data's done. But it's just not cost effective to bring in a big aircraft. So it's kind of all relative to project size and so forth. But you know, within a day, you can knock out a few of these couple hundred acre sites.
A little bit off topic, but out of curiosity, in today's world in mapping, obviously you're using the Cessnas and the fixed-wing aircraft. Is there a bigger uptick in mapping with helicopters these days?
No. You know, it seems like there was back in the early 2000s. There was a huge uptick. A lot of it had to do with transportation needs. A lot of, you know, you know, as we struggle to fund infrastructure, we're not building many new roads today, but we got a lot of them that need fixed. And so there was a huge swell of helicopter-type mapping application driven by the State Department of Transportation. I think what you're seeing is some other technologies are kind of weeding that, because that's, you know, helicopters are just expensive to operate. They're very costly. And so what you're seeing is things like mobile LIDAR technology that are vehicle-based. You know, we have a mobile LIDAR on a van. You're seeing right. Some of these other technologies a little more cost-effective. Me personally, I'm sure people that own helicopters and provide these services would argue with me, but I don't. It doesn't seem to be on the uptick to me.
Yeah. Earlier we were talking about. Let's talk about that 400 acres that we were discussing. Then that's in some remote area where somebody wants to build a place for rich people to retire or something. I don't know what the case might be, but it's not real close to an airport or anything.
Right.
What's the launch situation? Can you just launch the thing from the parking lot, or how does that work?
Ours is a hand launch system. Some of them actually have launching mechanisms, but ours is actually, you know, because again, it's 11 pounds. It's pretty easy. It's hand launchable. The motor electric, but it's very powerful, so the thing can jump to altitude. I mean, it can do pretty much as soon as it leaves the guy's hands. It's up and running. And in ours, you know, you have different levels. Some of them are nothing more than look like, you know, you go to the hobby shop and get a handheld remote control. A lot of them, that's all they have. We decided, again, thinking ahead, going more robust. Ours has a pretty ruggedized flight management system, and it has a software. So much like our fixed-wing aircraft today, we basically pre-plan and lay out our photo missions or LIDAR missions or what have you in the office. So it actually plans out the flight lines, the altitude, the spacing, actually when the camera will fire, the photo centers, all that's pre-planned in the software. And then, whether it be the fixed wing or now the UAS, it takes off on a predetermined flight path and goes and does its business. So, it goes through a landing procedure where it'll circle, spiral down, and just belly land in the grass.
And somebody is controlling that the whole time.
Absolutely. Getting back to FAA requirements, what you actually have is two folks. You've got someone sitting at the console, but you also have a observer. So that's actually kind of a two-person operation right now. So it's very safe, and you know, that's one of the things that I know Octavian's big on, and we will be, because unfortunately, you know, things will happen, you know, and when things happen, it'll get sensationalized, and it'll, you know, Lord willing, it won't be a mapping company that has something happen, but somebody will do something, it'll make the news, and then there'll be a big concern and worry about these things doing damage or flying into something they shouldn't. So, we've kind of went way over on the side of being as safe as possible with it. But again, at 11 pounds, you know, hopefully it isn't going to do too much damage if it hits some. But that's the other thing with the FAA for this COA process. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in place about where you can fly and where you can't, even whether you have a COA or not, and it's, you know, not around heavily populated areas, you know, not within, you know, all kinds of parameters around it. keep it safe.
And I guess as experience provides more data, maybe that will begin to change some, like in everything else. You know, there's always a concern going in, but I guess if there's data that proves you could get into different types of areas that are not just open, but I'm thinking now of mapping. One of the things I thought about, maybe this isn't even an application about, but I think I talked to Greg about this last week. When I was still running my business all full time, I had clients that had relatively small sites. Sometimes it might be a gas station site or something that they're going
right.
to totally rebuild or something. And I don't know if that's an application for something like this or not, but when I started thinking about it, I thought, well, that would have been pretty nice to have.
Yeah, no, absolutely could be. You know, and at the other end, there'll be a certain size project that you can go out there and with a robotic total station and knock it out, right? And with
right,
just
yeah.
ground. But so there'll be that sweet spot, but absolutely, I see a big application for this technology, at least with my company and our business model being more focused at today what we consider survey projects more than pure aerial mapping. It's going to cater in on some of these development sites where it's very survey intensive.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And I guess what I was thinking about in that application was just the intensity of the data you have to collect.
Yeah, I mean, you absolutely. Yeah. So that'd be where you could look at it from the cost benefit of. Yeah, if it's some area where it's just enormous amount of data collection, absolutely, like with any other photogrammetric project, that's the benefit of photogrammetry, being able to survey to some level of confidence from the air. So and that's the other thing, with this thing flying at 600 feet or lower, it's just incredible resolution and accuracy, right? I mean, we're getting down in the hundredths on accuracy, so it's truly survey grade accuracy. The photogrammetric measurements we're making, we've went out and extensively field tested it. Obviously, that's one thing we can do is do the field testing. It is a paradigm shift. I mean, it's going to be a neat application. It's going to, you've never been able to take measurements from the air like this before, right? Because you're just flying so much higher. But
sure, yeah, absolutely. Well, we're pretty close to our last break, so when we come back, we can maybe talk about some more of those applications. And I did want to get back to that concern of the small operators sometimes who think, well, this is going to run us out of business because anybody can now go do this. But as I think you pointed out before, some level of expertise has to still be there to process. So, so let's take that last break, and we'll come back.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953. First, with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity. Then, the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator. And most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back, everybody, to our last segment today with Jeff Lovin talking about UAV, UAS, and practical application for it. And we've had a really good conversation about it. When you were talking about hand launching, my untrained mind went back to my paper airplanes and those little wood ones we used to throw out through the air. But I guess
same technique.
Like
same technique.
Is that right? Except it goes further.
Yes.
Well, that's good. Heck, that I might find a job then. I was pretty good at launching
there
those things.
Well,
of course, that was 60 years ago, too. That's a little different time. But we were talking about the processing earlier, and ever since this topic has come up, I've been to chapter meetings and other surveyor meetings and pretty much all of those places we have members who do a variety of things, including photogrammetry, and some small operators, you know, guys that many of them don't own planes. They just, you know, do the processing and use somebody else to get the data for them. And there seems to be concern among all of them, well, oh, my gosh, we're going to be extinct now. And I don't know enough to know if that has any relevance or not.
Well, absolutely. I guess you could become extinct. The problem with this business especially, things change, and they change rapidly, and they seem to be changing. I know when I first got in the business, and, of course, my background is more in the photogrammetry, it seemed like every 5 years or so there was some big technological change that really morphed our business. First, you had analytic plotters, right? We weren't doing Mylar anymore. Then we went to digital orthophotography and what have you. And then LIDAR came along and then on the survey side. I remember, I've been at Wolpert long enough, I remember when GPS came along. And, man, that really divided the survey crowd at Wolpert, right?
Yeah.
Traditional versus GPS survey. So, if you want to, I guess, fold your arms and buy humbug one of these new things that come along, I guess it could damage your business, could relegate you to being on the sidelines. But I encourage everyone out there, and I have to do this cheerleading within my own company, both with photogrammetrists and surveyors, that guys, we have to embrace change. You gotta stay in front of the bus, or the bus is gonna run you over. So, it's definitely gonna change our business, no doubt about it.
We've really seen that. You talking about GPS and a lot of other technologies that have come along since I've been involved now, getting close to 50 years now.
Yeah.
So, just unbelievable change over that amount of time. And I think we've been a little slow most of the time, quite honestly, to adapt.
Yeah.
And make those changes, and the people who had the foresight to look ahead, like your Altavian folks, and like you guys are doing, then obviously there's going to be an advantage.
But a key to the relevance and us all staying relevant is, one, you got to be open minded and embrace it. But at the end of the day, you've got licensure issues to consider, and you've got to create a map or create a site design or site survey that you have to do that. And everyone gets excited and enamored about the technology. Private companies and clients, and they're cheap enough, relatively speaking, compared to larger systems, that people will run out and buy them. But then it's like, now what do I do? Well, you still need a licensed surveyor. You still need a photogrammetrist, because at the end of the day, you're trying to process, develop some data to do a design or do some sort of to work upon. And that's where we're still needed. We're still relevant. We're still needed, but. It is important we embrace these new technologies and figure out how to make them work for us and not against us.
You know, earlier on you mentioned the COA, the Certificate of Authorization. Is that the right terminology?
Yes.
And when we were talking on the phone earlier, you were saying that you guys had kind of gone through that process with a core project. Can you tell our folks a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, we worked with them, and they've applied for a COA, Certificate of Authorization, for an area along the Gulf Coast. And the mindset being that there's certain of these areas that really got hit hard by Hurricane Katrina, and probably will again someday, another big storm event, that were very tough post-storm to deploy any kind of technology in there to see what was happening, what was going on. We flew LIDAR with a fixed-wing aircraft the whole coast of Mississippi after Katrina, and we were one of the first aircraft in, but it still took several days because air traffic control was knocked out. there was no way to get fuel. You know, if we got down there to even got in to fly, we could have flown for 15 minutes, and then we'd had to start heading towards somewhere in Alabama, Florida, somewhere to get fuel because they're just all the, you know, everything was devastated. So, but what we were able to do is we got surveyors in there and had boots on the ground collecting data on the ground, you know, trying to help quantify the damage and so forth. So the mindset is with that kind of thing, with surveyors being able to get in there, this thing, you can carry it, get in there with one of these systems, set it up and deploy it, and you can, you know, cover a lot more ground more quickly and collect data. So with that mindset, they've applied for COAs of some of these storm-threatened areas. Some of them are like island areas there in the Gulf off the coast of Louisiana and so forth. And I believe they've received their approval of that COA for one of the particular areas. The next thing was getting, because it is the Army, they had to go a step further and get Army approval of the UAV. And I think that may have just happened as well. So that mission may be coming up soon where, we'll basically be, you know, lending our system, leasing it to the Corps, right, for them to operate and fly. And I think they'll have, the manufacturer involved or whatever. Because, again, we won't be able to fly it, but we'll be able to analyze, process the data for them once it's done. So, again, there's just, when you think of this new technology, there's a great application for it in some of these, you know, areas that in the past and probably unfortunately will be storm ravaged and, you know, not easy to go up and collect a bunch of data. It could be a great application for it. If we can get in there on foot, we can, you know, get within range, we can get this thing up and collect data that can be valuable to see what's going on the ground.
So what kind of a training curve does that take? If you say the college used your equipment and the Corps is going to use your equipment, do they inherently have people, or is there a training curve that's involved?
No, there's a big training curve, and they Altavian does a great job with the training program, right, to train people that purchase them. But that's the big focus of Sinclair at the heart of their mission, that community college, is training. So they're developing training courses to, one, apply for these COAs, these certificate authorizations, to fly and operate several different systems. One of the systems is the Altavian system. So the university has also bought an Altavian system and a few other brands, and they develop courses and training around, you know, how to operate those systems. So, you know, the Corps then, other folks can go to these classes. I know some of our clients have attended the both the COA class and others, some of our clients, just to get educated on the process.
You mentioned Sinclair. I'm just thinking back to my list. I think their program might be one of those on our list of our ABET accredited programs. I think it is, because that's what one of the things we do at NSPS is we do visits and evaluations for the surveying geomatics type programs that want accreditation by ABET, you know, the international accreditation body. And it seems to me like their program is one of those. I'll have to check into that. I believe it might be.
I would bet it is. And again, they've had a strong aviation program for many years as well. So it's a good fit tying these two together.
You may have mentioned this earlier, but thought came to me as you were just talking there a minute ago about launching the plane. Did we talk about battery life before? How long?
It's about 90 minute battery life on our system.
Okay, so I believe you did mention that. Okay, I just didn't write it down. It came to my mind as we were talking about it. So we got, I don't know, 4 minutes or 3.5 minutes or something to go. So before we get too deeply into anything else, first of all, I just want to thank you for being with me today. It's been really enlightening to talk to somebody who's sort of gotten into the weeds of this thing, so to speak, and really figuring out how to make it apply. So I think that's been really great for our audience to hear your perspectives on that. So I really appreciate you being with me again. I always enjoy it when you get to come on the show.
Thank you. I always appreciate the opportunity, and it's exciting topic, so it's easy to talk about.
So are you thinking this is the tip of the iceberg, or You know, every time we have something new, we think, boy, this is the thing. So I don't know.
I do. I think it is. I think over time, you know, more of the airspace will be opened up as we all get through the just the concern of this technology, and the FAA gets things, you know, figured out. Like I said, over time, I think, you know, a company like mine will be able to fly larger unmanned systems. And back to my comment, we got an aging fleet that can't fly forever. And I think unmanned is the answer. And I think maybe before I retire, you know, almost all of our, a lot of our data collection could be done with unmanned systems. And again,
speaking
of, talking about today is very small site specific, but I can see in the future very large projects being done with a, you know, a larger system.
Speaking of the flying part, in my conversations with John and Greg, we talked about this, but I'm not sure I ever got clear on whether or not a pilot is required, a licensed pilot. Is that situational?
No, I believe, I guess since even Greg didn't know, but I think he does, but I think it is a requirement. Licensed pilot has to be operating that and on site.
That was the impression I got, but then something that we talked about led me to believe that maybe in certain circumstances that wasn't the case. So anyway,
licensed pilot. So again, you know, no fear out there to existing aerial mapping pilots. They'll still have something to fly. May not be
a job.
Glamorous or fun, but it's climbing in the seat of a bigger twin engine, but we're still going to be flying and collecting data, just be operating it from the ground, I guess.
Right. Well, one of the things you said today that I think will embolden and hearten our audience is when you said we're still going to need surveyors and photogrammetrists, and that's an important thing for us to remember, that we just have to be prepared. They're going to be needed, but we still have to be prepared.
Yep. I mean, there's still a need for the professionals, still need for the profession. Technology is just an enabler, and this is just, you know, this is just another tool, right? We've got GPS, we've got LIDAR, and now we'll have unmanned aircraft. It's just a tool. At the end of the day, you still need some sort of professional to make knowledgeable, actionable data out of it.
Well, thanks so much, Jeff, for being with me today. I really appreciate it. It's been really enlightening.
Yep, thank you.
Take care.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.